Hello and welcome to the Central Asian podcast, Majlis. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. The anticipated nuclear discussion between Iran and major world powers is finally in the new chapter. The agreement signed over the weekend between the parties, on one hand, the international sanctions is expected to ease. On the other hand, this deal is expected to have significant ramifications regionally. The optimistic scenario is, first and foremost, internationally integrated Iran will help the landlocked Central Asia to connect to the world, find new routes for the region to import and export, which is free of Russian domination. In this panel, we intend to discuss what does the Iranian nuclear deal means to Central Asia. Joining me in the discussion is Dr. Lokan Checi, Director of Central Asian Studies Center at Glasgow University. Dr. Loka, welcome to the show.
Hello, Mohammed.
From Newcastle, an independent Iranian analyst and former deputy head of the Iranian service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Hussein Aryan is joining us. Mr. Aryan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mohammed.
Hi. And also joining me, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today. Before to jump in Central Asia, let's try first to understand what this deal is about and what does it contain. Mr. Aryan, you have been following the Iranian negotiations from the day first. Please give us some insight and highlights of the deal.
Well, first of all, I think the nuclear deal has provided a kind of environment that Iran can come back to the international community and ended its isolation. In terms of nuclear issues, Iran's low-enriched uranium has decreased from 8,702 kilograms to about less than 300 kilograms. The rest of it has been shipped to Russia. Its medium-enriched uranium has been decreased to zero. Its centrifuges from nearly 20,000 from the first generation has decreased to 6,000, and advanced centrifuges have been reduced to zero. So the breakdown time from 1 to 2 months has been increased to 1 year, and it has actually stopped the whole issue, which was developing, to becoming a real crisis in the region, to a kind of calmer environment where Iran can operate. And at the same time, it has provided Iran an opportunity in terms of trade, shipping, insurance, selling its crude oil. So hopefully it will be beneficial to Iran's economy.
Right. Dr. Luca, what does those articles that Mr. Aryan has mentioned means to Central Asia?
Well, it means that probably the last border to be artificially sealed is going to be opening from now on. It wasn't a geographical border that was obstructed by the sanction. It was an economic one, a financial one. And I think that we will see that having this kind of re-entry, if you want, of the Islamic Republic onto the world stage does actually favor the Central Asian. In what you were saying before, Muhammad, having an easier access to the global markets, to the open sea, to the Gulf, if you want, to a series of opportunities that to date were really obstructed by the fact that the Iranian economy, which, by the way, I think is the largest outside of the WTO at the moment, was pretty much preventing them to acquire. So I think that in general terms, this is a welcome development, a positive development for Central Asia. The timing, we could discuss this later on, is probably not the best because the crisis is getting harder this year. But overall, lifting the sanctions, re-entry on global markets of Iran is a possibility that Central Asia should really welcome.
Right, positive development, especially for energy-producing countries. Bruce, what does it say about diversification of energy routes for landlocked Central Asia?
Energy is actually probably going to be the hardest nut to crack, so to speak, because We know that Iran, having been kept out of the world oil and gas markets for more than two decades now, really, is going to be anxious to sell its own oil and gas. On paper, just looking at a map, of course, it would work out fantastically for Kazakhstan to export oil and Turkmenistan to export gas. But Iran is also going to consider its own needs and its own exports first and foremost, I would imagine. So if there are going to be, and I imagine there will be energy exports coming from Central Asia through Iran, but they're going to be in small volumes at first, and it's going to have to increase over time. And that will probably hinge on how quickly Iran is able to get its own exports out to market and how much money it brings in. If it's a success very early on and they're able to export the volumes that they would like to, they will be a lot more willing to let Central Asian partners use Iran as a transit route for its energy exports.
Considering that Turkmenistan already have two existing pipelines that are exporting or ready to export gas to Iran, right?
Yeah, and that's very true. I mean, you know, in theory, again, on the map, it's very easy for Iran and Turkmenistan. It would be very easy for them to come to a deal where they just link the existing pipelines coming into Iran from Turkmenistan to pipelines that are headed further west. But I don't think that will be one of the priorities of the Iranian government. They will be looking to get their own gas hooked into pipelines that are headed westward. Before they let Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan in on such a deal. That said, it's not inconceivable that China would talk to Iran and say, we already have some pipelines in Turkmenistan, and we could build another one, and you could contribute to it too. So
you are touching another very interesting subject, Bruce Panier.
Obviously, if Iran becomes a player or a export hub, there will be some winners, as in case of Turkmenistan, and there will also be some losers. What kind of reaction is expected regionally, Mr. Aryan, in that aspect?
Well, Iran, I think I agree with Bruce. I think first and foremost will be thinking of its own interest. Iran had, in 2011 was exporting something like 2.5 million barrels of oil per day. And then after sanctions, it actually decreased to something round about a million. So now, more than anything else, as Iranian officials have stressed, that they want to increase the output. Obviously, we'll be looking for more customers in Europe, because previously Iran was selling its oil to China, South Korea, India, and now will try to come back. And it's ironic, at this particular time where the price of oil is going down and less than $30 per barrel, and Iran is trying, to increase it. But that's what the Iranian officials have said. But at the same time, in the context of, the Caspian region and, Central Asia, Iran is quite eager to absorb, to attract foreigners to participate in the development of its oil fields, something like about 50. And about four of them would be actually in the Caspian Sea, including the Sardar-e-Jangal oil field. Iran wants to develop that. I think to begin with, Iran will be thinking more about its own interest and how to actually sort of boost its oil production.
So long time before Turkmenistan is able to benefit from this route, as you say, Mr. Aryan. Dr. Luca, if and when Iran becomes a functional route for the energy export, one of the biggest losers is going to be, in case of Turkmenistan at least, Azerbaijan, maybe Russia, or maybe a little bit China. What kind of reactions are you expecting from them if it goes in an optimistic direction, as we are talking about?
First of all, I must say that I agree with Bruce. This is a very long shot.
Right.
Iran, after all, is a Gulf country. And if we look at the patterns of energy cooperation between Central Asia and the Gulf, the Arab states tended to look at competitors more than as collaborators. So in that sense, I don't think that it would be quickly happening, the sort of cooperation. But should that happen, this could be a revolutionary development, in the sense that we will see patterns of cooperation that have been so far established be turned on their own and changing into more loose arrangements. I think that China is probably the most interesting case because the way in which the demand of China has been, articulated, that was always done in order not to have too much dependency on a single source. And having Iran now able to produce more and to sell more, actually something that China could benefit a lot, probably at the detriment of Turkmenistan. In the case of Azerbaijan, I really don't know what the perception of this deal in Baku might be. They could push towards maybe some sort of arrangement for, if you want, trying to stabilize the legal situation, agree on something on the Caspian Sea, because that could boost the potential of extraction. And if you look along on a wider region, Russia then, well, Russia got many problems at the moment. I don't think they can worry too much with hypothesis of what Iran would do. But my main point today would have been the one about infrastructure. I think that rather on energy, Iran can be a real game changer for transport infrastructure, railways, freeways, roadways. That's something that could happen, and that could actually change a lot in terms of the connectivity of Central Asia with the rest of the world. This is something which I think is more important rather than the pipelines that might or more likely will not happen.
Right. I know, Bruce, you have some points to discuss about the winners and losers situation within the region in Central Asia. We were especially talking about Tajikistan a little bit earlier. But the other question I would want to ask you is, the deal over the weekend has been a big, big subject everywhere. Lots of pundits are talking about this. What kind of reaction you have been getting from Central Asian leaders about this?
Of course, they're not reacting publicly. I think it is significant that if you look at the number of embassy changes that have been made, both from the Iranian side to their Central Asian embassies and from Central Asian countries to their Iranian embassies in the last 3 months, you will see that they've replaced ambassadors, a number of officials. So this was something that is people were already thinking about before the actual lifting of some of these sanctions over this last weekend. They pre-positioned themselves for this. So we are going to see a new era of diplomacy between Central Asia and Iran. There's no doubt about it. I would tend to agree with Luca about the significance of this as being not so much the energy exports, but the fact that it is a new export route and lump a number of products that can go back and forth. Now, with Iran as a much shorter route, sea to the sea, as Luca pointed out, to Europe, if they can get some kind of cooperation between Iran and Turkey, and I know that that's not a hugely optimistic proposition at the moment, but for years, if Central Asia wanted to export something west, they had to go through Russia. Those days are coming to an end. You know, they've got the links with China now. So this is, you know, people always want to talk about the ancient Silk Route and the recreation of the Silk Route. Well, this is about as close to the recreation of the ancient Silk Route as we've seen since the Soviet Union fell apart. So I think that's going to be the big benefit to Central Asia. They're going to become transit countries, and they're going to be able to get what goods they produce, which by and large is agricultural, to markets much easier. Now, at least once they start to improve some of the infrastructure, railway links being first and foremost, I would imagine.
Right. But before it turns to the ancient Silk Route, what time frame we are looking at that? I mean, what is the day, which is the year when we can expect the Central Asian countries is taking direct benefit from the Iranian option?
Forecasting's a dangerous game, but I'm going to say it's going to be minimum 5 years and probably closer to 10 before we really start to see the big payoff, the benefits from new cooperation with Iran and Central Asia.
Right. Mr. Aryan, the same question to you. What time frame are you
looking at? I agree with that. It will take, quite a while. And Iran has must do, a lot to improve its infrastructure in order to become a corridor for trade or transfer of oil from Central Asian countries. However, Iran has taken a step in order to improve its port called Jask, which is on east of Bandar Abbas, and that is supposed to be, and Iran hopes that in the next, you know, less than a decade or so, will become another sort of terminal for export, like Karg Island, which is, you know, on the inside the Persian Gulf. Jask is sort of more or less close to the Strait of Hormuz towards the Gulf of Oman. So it will take time. It cannot be, you know, immediate. It will be a number of years.
Right. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will discuss another aspect of this deal, that is the close connection with Iran is a double-edged sword, especially under current circumstances. If the optimistic scenario become a reality, it also means greater influence of Iran in the region. Where does it put Central Asia's interest? Stay tuned. Welcome back to the show. Today we are discussing the what the Iranian deal means to Central Asia. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Luka Ancici, Director of Central Asian Studies Center at Glasgow University, Hussein Aryan, an Iranian independent analyst, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Araf Yarali's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Welcome, gentlemen, again to the show. So there are two aspects I want to discuss in this phase of the debate. The first, potential Iranian influence in the region. Second, political implications of getting closer to Iran. Let's dwell a little bit about the second leg of the argument first. As you know, Iran and controversy always goes side by side. Recently, it is engaged in a war of words with Saudi Arabia, and it is also not in a friendly terms with Turkey and dozens of other countries. So what's the cost of coming closer to Iran, Mr. Aryan?
Well, Iran's foreign policy, and you know, would be very controversial to me. It's not going to change, you know, easily. First of all, the spiritual leader and, to a large extent, the revolutionary guards, a very powerful organization in the country, they're not really pleased with the United States of America, and they would probably do everything to actually undermine what Rouhani is trying to achieve. Politically, they say, well, you know, the agreement, the nuclear agreement is fine, but that doesn't mean that Iran is going to be, friendly towards the United States of America. Apart from that, Iran will try, you know, to pursue its aim as it's doing now in the region, in the context of proxy war, which is conducting, with Saudi Arabia. At the moment, there is no sort of indication that the so-called Cold War between these two countries would end up to a conflict, but all the ingredients are there. And if it's not really controlled, and these two countries do not come, that means Iran and Saudi Arabia, to some kind of grand bargain, whether by talking to each other or with help of other countries, including United States, Pakistan, or European countries, we could see a kind of clash in the future. Iran would pursue its proxy war in Lebanon, in Syria, right, in Iraq, and in Yemen. So while the nuclear agreement, we are hopeful that will bring benefits to Iran, and especially to Iran's economy, at least what is the expectation. In terms of foreign policy, I do not think it would change a lot, especially that now Iran, with its frozen asset, has been, you know, unblocked, although there is a debate on that figure, between 30 billion to 50 billion, according to U.S. Treasury, and to $100 billion, according to some people. So that would probably provide Iran with kind of money to pursue some of its foreign policy aggressively in the region. I do not see, in the current circumstances, a big change in Iran's stance in this regard.
Right. Dr. Luca, in the first half of the show, you have been talking about the how positive aspect of the Iranian route that's going to open for Central Asia, and the fact that Iran is engaged with lots of proxy war or war of words, especially the Saudi Arabia being a spiritual center of Sunni Muslims, and also most of the holy Islamic sites being in Saudi Arabia. It has a huge role in Islamic world. And Central Asian countries also have their own relations with Saudi Arabia, for instance, in terms of religion, and also are in good terms with Turkey due to lots of other aspects. So how much of Iranian foreign policy is going to be a problem for Central Asia in terms of benefiting what Iran offers in case it opens up?
If there is one thing which I don't think the Central Asian leaders change that much, is how they relate to foreign influence in terms of religion. So Central Asia Islam will always be insulated from whatever force is from the outside, and be that Saudi Arabia, be that Turkey, and be now also Iran. So I don't really think that there will be much of a change in the sort of any influence that sort of Iran could sort of play through in terms of soft power, so religious influence on Central Asia. Mostly because the first reaction, and I just read what the Kazakh Ministry of Foreign Affairs said, has been of balancing between the two, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran. The document I read, which was the reaction of Kazakhstan to the deal, actually called for appeasement between the two, called both countries brothers of Kazakhstan. So I think the Central Asian would be very careful not to get too close to Iran, but also not to get in too distant to Iran, because I think that in terms of economic, so beyond energy, the benefits could be quite substantive. So we will see a lot of the balancing act to happen in the next few months. That's why I'm not surprised of what Bruce said before about the fact that there's been a high turnover in terms of diplomatic personnel, because probably this new representative in the region will try to enforce this policy of balancing with Iran. But I don't really see that much changing in this area, Mohammed.
Right. The balancing aspect when dealing with Iran is an interesting question. I have this in my list, but perhaps I will go back again to another aspect of the Iranian foreign policy. We have seen this in Iraq, in Syria, and most visibly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. When the countries are in a better ties with Iran, Iran finds its way, the Iranian regime, I should say, finds its way to influence or meddle in the internal affairs of those countries with lots of different ways, cultural centers, religious schools, lots of other things. How much of big headache do you see Central Asia is in, especially being a weaker partner in with Iran in this aspect, Bruce?
Well, let me start this by saying that when the Central Asian republics became independent after the fall of the Soviet Union, Iran was the Islamic fundamentalist, radical, whatever you want to call it, threat that they first saw. So that's how, and since most of the leaders in power, you know, the three out of the five, were there at that time, this is probably still their general view of Iran. Iran, as we've heard, as Hossein mentioned, they're waging proxy wars. Iran is trying to expand its influence wherever it can, and Central Asia will not be an exception to this, without a doubt. However, as I mentioned, the Central Asian countries, the governments are very wary about Iran. Now, at the moment, the economic problems that the Central Asians are facing are also going to play a big role, because they're going to need, if Iran can make significant investments into Central Asia, it's really going to strain the balancing act a lot, because this is going to, for the Central Asian governments facing, you know, the potential of social unrest within their countries, this is one of those things they can hold out in front of the people and say, look, we have a new partner, we have a new export route, things are going to get better, hang on, you know, much the way they did with China right after the turn of the century, some 15 years ago, where they were able to say, look, you know, we have a new partner and things are going to change. And they did, you know, for the better, you would have to say generally. Iran's a little trickier because it's a co-religionist, although it's Shiite as opposed to the Sunnis of Central Asia. So it is going to be a very difficult balancing act, because we can probably safely assume the Iranian government is going to have more and more money, not just the money that's about to be unfrozen, but revenues from sales of its own oil and gas. and therefore will be in a financial position to meddle more, and certainly with Central Asia right next door, you know, it's going to be quite a temptation to some people in Iran, and the financial factor will be a temptation to a lot of the people in Central Asia too. We've seen that economics override religion and politics many, many times in world history. So I wouldn't count out the fact that Iran would gain a better foothold, more influence in Central Asia. But, you know, at the same time, we got to understand that Iran was the original Islamic threat to Central Asia when they all became independent. I don't think that's been forgotten.
Right. Mr. Aryan, you were talking about a little earlier about that Iran is not going to change the foreign policy it pursues with any deal. So economic interest in Iranian influence. So what is the right balance for Central Asians when dealing with Iran?
I think for the Central Asian countries, they have to choose the kind of right path and the sort of balance. Obviously, they're not pleased, and they will not be, with Iran's, you know, influence there in terms of religion. But I suppose if they can somehow keep their distance, come to some kind of agreement with Iran, I mean, the kind of relations that, for instance, say, between Azerbaijan and Iran that we are seeing, you know, sort of stop Iran's meddling in other countries' affairs, but, you know, just conduct the sort of normal, you know, down-to-earth economic, you know, ties, trades, or whatever. Otherwise, are going to be very difficult, as we have seen, for instance, with Tajikistan and Iran, you know, recently, because of the... you know, what Iran did in terms of, you know, inviting one of the religious leaders in Tajikistan and then his meeting with Ayatollah Khamenei and the rest of it. And, you know, things have not really been very good lately between Iran and Tajikistan. So this is a kind of example that we might see in the future. It, I think, a lot has to do with Central Asian countries to kind of draw a red line, come with some kind of agreement with Iran, and then I think the process, you know, can go ahead and the sort of ties can flourish economically.
Right, right. Thank you, Mr. Aryan. We should be wrapping up the discussion, but final words, Bruce?
Well, yeah, because I can kind of follow up on what Hossein was just talking about, too. You know, we were talking about the winners and losers in this thing.
Yeah.
I think without a doubt, the big winner in this whole equation is Turkmenistan. It will take a while, but Turkmenistan is the gateway to Iran. They stand to gain a huge amount if they can be patient, if they can keep their population patient. Within Central Asia, I would mention that following up on that the Tajik-Iranian spat that we've seen lately, Tajikistan stands to be potentially the biggest loser of this deal because they certainly can't practice the kind of politics that we've seen in the last month if this trade route works out with Iran, because Iran will have better relations with all the other four Central Asian states. Tajikistan is not along any kind of major export route between Iran and China. It's easy to bypass it entirely. For historical reasons, for linguistic reasons, for cultural reasons, Iran and Tajikistan are unlikely to cut ties entirely. But it could be the case that Iran would be in a position to certainly downgrade the importance of its ties with Tajikistan if Tajikistan continues to keep the stance that it's had for the last few weeks.
Right. Dr. Luka?
I would, just to follow on, yeah. I would really like everyone to rethink what Kazakhstan can gain out of this. I think that we've seen a lot of development in the Kazakhstan's infrastructure policy in the last 3 or 4 years. Some of them are really puzzling, like having new trains and new railroads when the passenger numbers is going, is decreasing. But I think that the possibility of having a new route that goes down the south could actually be some sort of big solution for all this big spending and going on for Kazakhstan. I think that, and having a good new linkages with Iran is actually something that could turn a little bit of the tide of this bit of a problematic situation in which the economy of Kazakhstan is. So, of course, Turkmenistan is the biggest winner.
but Kazakhstan could be a winner as well.
Right, winners and losers. I believe we have long time to see how it goes, how it is realized in the future. With this, Dr. Luka Ancheschi, Director of the Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University, thank you very much for your insightful comments. Also, Hussein Aryan, an independent Iranian journalist, and Bruce Panier, the editor of RFRL's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Thank you for taking time for being with us, gentlemen, in this show.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.